Good evening and welcome to another edition of Dialogue. My name's Garland Nixon and I'm here with
Mark Levine
and
Terry D. Kester, the doctor.
The doctor of democracy.
And we are the Raucous Caucus.
Yes. And tonight we have a very special guest with us. We have Congresswoman Donna Edwards. Thank you very much for joining us tonight here.
Thanks. It's great to be here. And I usually call the Democratic Caucus the Raucous Caucus.
Oh, no. We're way more.
We're as raucous as they are, if not more.
Yeah, we're trying to lay claim
to that. In
fact,
we give raucous lessons if they're needed.
We're here every Tuesday, 7 to 8 p.m., here at Ben's Next Door, 1213 U Street. There's still plenty of time for you to show up.
That's next door to Ben's Chili Bowl.
Right next door to Ben's Chili Bowl.
For those who don't know about Ben's Next Door.
So we're going to be here. We'll be here from 7 to 8 p.m., and we're going to be talking today with Congressman Donna Edwards. Thank you very much for showing up.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, we have a great time here, and certainly you're welcome anytime you want to come.
Good. I'm looking forward to the fun.
Great.
Okay. Next week, we're still here, 7 o'clock, Tuesday.
Well,
expect to see you.
Garland, why don't you just, for the very few people in the Washington metro area who don't know who Congresswoman Donna Edwards is, why don't you tell us just a little about her and where she represents?
Well, why don't we let the Congresswoman?
All right, fair enough.
Okay. Sure, I know how to do that. I'm Donna Edwards. I represent Maryland's 4th Congressional District.
Which is where?
And our district, it covers most of Prince George's County and then part of the eastern part of Montgomery County. So about two-thirds of the district is in Prince George's County and a third of the district is in Montgomery County.
Terrific.
Excellent. And how long have you been in holding that seat?
Complicated question, but I came in a special election in June 2008, and so I've been serving since then and began my regular term with the election in November 2008, and facing a primary election in September and a re-election in November.
Well, we certainly wish the best for you.
Thank you.
Something we want to talk about, I know one of the things we want to do is talk about some of the issues that you've been working on lately, and let me just say this. These are some things that we've been griping, complaining, and jumping up and down about.
So. Analyzing.
Particularly Terry's been griping.
Well, analyzing.
Well, I'll put it like this. Mark and I have been talking about it.
Terry's been griping, jumping up and down.
I'm the idealist, just so you know.
But campaign finance reform, certainly we know that in Washington, one of the problems that's causing dysfunction is money coming from special interests.
You know, before I came into Congress, I worked on issues around campaign finance reform for the public interest group, Public Citizen, and on the board of Common Cause. And so I know the issue really well. And I'm going to tell you something. It's actually even worse inside than I thought from the outside.
Really?
And that's because money really does dominate policy and politics. And it's really an unfortunate situation. But here we are now. We're looking at a Gulf spill, oil spill. And we can see the domination of the oil industry controlling its own regulations that really have allowed this situation to creep and crawl and now inundate us. We came out of a financial crisis with a financial industry that had gone completely, really unregulated for many years. And we came in a health care reform debate in which the big fight was against what? The insurance companies.
Sure,
and so it's no question that politics is really dominated by money, and I think we got to get the money out of politics.
How are we going to do that, Congresswoman? Because, I mean, this is one of the reasons the American public is so angry. There's no question about it, because they know this, whether be they on the right, on the left, or centrist. They know that money talks. They know they don't have access in any way comparable to the money. How do we get towards public financing or anything else that's going to make a difference?
Well, I think some of it starts with individuals. And I know that when I came into Congress, I've been really clear that I want, you know, my money to come from small contributors. So much of the money that I raise as a candidate really does come from small contributors, but from others also. But I think that we have to really change the system. And I'm a strong proponent of public financing of elections. I think if the public doesn't own our elections, then the other guys do.
Yeah, exactly.
And frankly, it'll be cheaper for us.
With the Citizens United case, though, it seems like the public's getting less and less of a role. Exxon or BP alone, for example, could spend more money just on its profits than every American spent in the whole 2008 presidential election. The corporations are getting more powerful. How the heck are we going to get public financing if we can't even fight the Supreme Court?
Well, let me tell you, I mean, for people who don't know, the Citizens United case was decided earlier this year in which the Supreme Court said, you know what? Corporations can dig into their own public treasuries and contribute as much money they want to support or defeat a candidate. I think this is really dangerous. I think that they have misread the Constitution and that they're taking our elections away from us, and we can't let that happen. And so I think while we need a system of public financing, it's also really important for us to get constitutional restraints on corporations. And I've proposed a constitutional amendment,
really?
House Resolution 74, that would say that Congress has the authority to regulate corporate expenditures. And unless we give Congress that authority in the Constitution, the Supreme Court has said corporations can spend what they want.
But you need two-thirds vote of both houses. I mean, you're never going to get Republicans to vote for that.
Hold on a second. Here's where I think people are stronger than politicians, because I think that if people across this country, and we've been seeing it in the response to our constitutional amendment, that left, right, and center, people believe that corporations should not have the authority that Congress, that the courts have given to them. And so I believe in the power of organizing and getting the word out, talking to people about the importance of changing the Constitution in this limited kind of instance so that we can take our politics back.
But shouldn't it go further than that with a constitutional amendment? I mean, shouldn't you go to the point of making it perfectly clear that in the United States, under the law, a citizen is a human being, not a corporation, and they should, because legally, corporations do have almost all the same rights, and in some cases, many more rights, than the average citizen. How did we get to that point, and don't we need a constitutional amendment that says, no, a corporation is not a citizen?
It's a legal
fiction. A double-edged sword, because I have to tell you, in the instance of like looking at BP and Transocean, right now, I want them prosecuted like a person.
Right.
I want them fined like a person.
How do you put a corporation in jail? If you help me out here, I'll put you.
But they have CEOs.
That's true.
So sometimes be careful what you wish for. But I do agree with you that I want to get to the point where we're actually having a real debate, a serious debate about the constitutional limitations that corporations should have. And we can't get that without what I believe is I've pushed the envelope here with a constitutional amendment to give the Congress the authority to regulate these corporations. And then Congress can come back under the power of the people and say, you know what, they can't contribute and spend on campaigns in an unlimited way. We can put restrictions on them and turn the tables so that we turn elections back to people.
Once again, you're listening to 89.3 WPFW. My name's Garland Nixon. I'm here with
Terry DeCastro
and Mark Levine
and Congresswoman Donna Edwards.
I'd like to be able to do that part myself.
Go right ahead.
Let's start over again.
Okay,
I'm here with Mark Levine
and
Terry DeCastro
and
Donna Edwards.
Hey,
all right. We're here at Ben's Next Door, right next to Ben's Chili Bowl, 1213 U Street. So there's still plenty of time to come and check out. It's a live show. We're having a great time. You know, something that you and Terry hit on I think was very interesting, and that is I tend to sometimes listen to right-wing talk radio, and I have noticed
that— And your ears don't burn?
Well, it lasts until I rip my radio out of the dashboard and heave it out the window, and then I got to buy a new radio.
I hear you.
But at any rate, what I've noticed is even on right-wing talk radio, many of the conservative callers are unhappy with the Citizens United case. So have you seen any polls or anything that indicates that you may be able to get something done constitutionally?
Well, we've seen polls that say that more than two-thirds of the American public believes that the Citizens United case was wrongly decided by the United States
Supreme
Court.
Do they know what it is? I worry that they don't know. I mean, I know President Obama spoke about it in State of the Union, and Justice Alito is shaking his head no. Of course, Alito was wrong. But I worry, Citizens United, it sounds good. I mean, Citizens United.
But, you know,
do you really think American people know about this? And what can we as radio hosts, what can you as a member of Congress do to explain this? The decision, which is somewhat complex in a way that people get it and want to fight it.
Well, it's not that complex. The Supreme Court has decided that under our Constitution, corporations can reach into their own treasury, into their own pocketbooks, and spend unlimited amounts on campaign. It is said, in effect, that the voice of people, of corporations, is more powerful than the voice of individual people. I think people get that. We're hearing from the left, the right, and the center in our office about this. I've been on right-wing talk radio, and people are just calling in saying, we want to do this.
Even right-wingers do.
Even right-wingers do.
Yeah,
left, right, and center.
God help them all.
I was about to say, believe me, you're not the only one here who's been on right-wing talk.
Don't go there, please. Please, we have some standards. This is WPFW, Progressive Radio in the United States, Pacifica.
Right.
Just to remind you.
Something else important regarding campaign finance reform, and that is I understand there's been something put forward, a bill put forward by Congressman Van Hollen and Senator Schumer called the Disclose Act. Or something like that? Can you fill us in a bit on that?
It is a Disclose Act, and I've signed on to it. It is intended to fix some of the disclosure problems that the Supreme Court has decided that Congress does have the ability to do with respect to corporate behavior. I'm offering an amendment, actually, to the Disclose Act as we introduce it that says in the event that those things are struck down by the Supreme Court, then it is, a resolution and a view of the Congress that we should consider a constitutional amendment, because I, in reading the court's decision, and I read Citizens United actually three times. I'm a little bit of a geek on those things.
I read it once, got disgusted, and threw it down.
Yeah. There you go. But, and I highlighted mine. And so I think one of the, you know, one of the problems that I find is that the court has left very, very little room for the Congress to act. And so I'm worried that we will go through this process. It'll be challenged in court, go through years of court challenge, and then be struck down, and we'll still be left with nothing. That's why I say the constitutional amendment actually is not a long shot, because when you think about the time it takes for a case to wind its way up to the United States Supreme Court with a decision, you could be spending your time organizing on a constitutional amendment,
But Congresswoman, I want to follow up on Terry's point earlier about a corporation, you know, which was declared a person, and anyone who knows legal history knows this happened because kind of the error of the person who was following it in 1886. Can't you just say, as a simple matter, a corporation is not a person under the Constitution? In other words,
not
you
a
can
citizen.
Regulate how you want. That a corporation has all the rights that states or the Congress gives to it, but has no rights as a person, quote-unquote, under the Constitution. I mean, would you sponsor an amendment like that?
Sure, I would. Let me tell you what's happened, though. I think that I introduced this constitutional amendment, House Resolution 74, with Chairman John Conyers of the Judiciary Committee.
Big fan.
We were thinking this is a way for the two of us to partner and try to move something through the Judiciary Committee and really move it forward, knowing the resistance that we were getting. If this comes up in front of the committee and there's a hearing and there's testimony and there's an amendment offered to do exactly what you said, guess what? Donna Edwards will not
right.
be opposing
that. All right, that's good
that.
To hear. Good to hear.
Let me ask
cheer for that. Come on, everybody.
Ah, we need that. Yeah.
Let me throw a question to Terry, and that is this, something that we're talking about here, and just your opinion. You know, it seems to me now that everything kind of runs headlong into the Supreme Court. I even wonder about what's going to happen when it comes to health care reform when it gets to the Supreme Court.
It tied up for years.
Right. So do you think we're in a situation where the only way to get things done is through constitutional amendments because anything that's fairly progressive or even centrist will be struck down by the Supreme Court?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that, you know, fairly looked upon a challenge in the United States Supreme Court, for example, on health care. I think most analysts say, you know what, this stuff is like, you know, shooting in the wind. It's not going to happen. And so I actually have every confidence that our health care law will be held up.
On law. Did you forget Bush v. Gore? Sometimes the law doesn't apply.
Yeah, let me just say, I still actually have confidence in our Constitution. I actually
still
have
confidence. Constitution. It's just the court. I don't have confidence.
I have confidence that we can, if we don't have a court today that's going to do the right thing, that, you know, things happen. There are transitions at some points on courts, and we will have that kind of transition. I think the important thing is that we keep, you know, a strong Democratic president in the White House to make sure that not this 4 years, but the next 4 years, when we know that there will come vacancies on the court, that we have somebody who's going to appoint somebody who's going to look at the Constitution in a way that favors people over corporations.
Let me just, I think it's bigger than this, and I would like to know your reaction. And it's sort of a big question, but I mean, there's so many aspects of our government that are just totally out of control. Even if you got your constitutional amendment passed, that's not going to stop the flow of money. We know that. Public financing of elections on a national level is probably never going to happen. The appointments made by
For the record, for those of you that can't see a face on radio, Congresswoman Edwards made a face when she said that because she thinks it is going
to
happen.
In other words, to be honest, Terry, I tell you you're wrong
all the time. Yeah. She's too nice, but she did it with her face. I saw it.
I thought she was going to take a swipe at you.
I just want you to know.
We agree with you, Congresswoman.
She's willing to say she did do it with her face.
It's nothing new. Mark makes faces at me all the time, you know, and I'm used to it. But I mean, there's so many things that seem to be, and the American public is losing confidence in our government in so many different ways. One of the things, even including today, which I wasn't quite aware of, President Obama has only been able to pass and get 64% of the 400 and some odd main positions that he needs to replace in the government. You know, I mean, the government is bogged down. It is bogged down in Congress, which doesn't work. It's bogged down in the courts. It's bogged down in the presidency and the administration. How do we restore the faith that Americans need in this government, in this system? How do you do that? Because that's what's lacking at this point. And that's so detrimental and so dangerous, because once the people lose faith, that's what allows for all the extremism.
I know, but we can't fuel the lack of confidence. And so, for example, mm-hmm. I would say to you, let's separate the – let's not talk about the big Congress. Let's talk about the House and the Senate. I think the House of Representatives
has been – So we're going to close the Senate?
Well, let me just finish. I think the House of Representatives has been incredibly productive over this last 2 years. And let's not underestimate what it meant to get – even though it wasn't the perfect health care law passed, the health care law through this Congress, what seven presidents haven't been able to do, generations haven't been able to do, and we were able to get that to the president to sign into law. Does that mean that there aren't still other big picture things that have passed the House and are sitting over there in what I sometimes describe as the wasteland of the Senate, waiting to be acted upon? But those are things over which voters actually do have control. And so my view is that we have to actually continue to give the voice to voters so that we can inspire them to have the control that they really do. I mean, I don't want people out there giving up, because I think if we give up, we give up on future generations.
Neither and do so I, we look, but it is happening.
You know, but what we have to do is we actually have to have leaders who don't just inspire, but who do. Leaders who are also willing to go out and organize their colleagues. I know I spend a lot of my time, because I organized before I came into the Congress. Trust me. Inside the Congress, my role is as an organizer, trying to bring, you know, people together collectively to have a voice where otherwise that would be absent. That's part of the process. And engaging. We have an important opportunity coming up here with these midterm elections. This is going to say, where are we going to go in the future? And we can't, you know, just say, oh, just throw our hands up, and especially as progressives,
I'm
election.
I'm concerned that there are progressives that are disappointed in President Obama and are going to stay home. I mean, I'm worried.
You know what I say as a progressive? Let's get over that.
Right.
Because those other guys, when they're in charge, we already know what they do when they're in charge. We can't let them be in charge again.
That brings out a good question, and that something you were saying about organizing. With the midterms coming up, what can be done? Clearly, the Republican Party is, they're saying that they're going to make great, you know, strides, and they're going to pick up a lot of seats, but there are a lot of people like me who don't necessarily agree with them. I don't really see that happening. But how do we motivate people? How do you get people to recognize the importance of it? What is there we can do? You know, Terry's our take to the streets guy.
And I am happy to announce that Congressman Donna Edwards has been to the streets and has been arrested. And I mean, I admire that. I mean, if we had more congresspersons with that kind of courage,
If Terry had his way, all of Congress would be in jail.
So my question
is... Well, there's that, too. Right. Yeah. Can we hear it for that? All of Congress in jail?
No, Terry, we can't hear it for that.
And my mother doesn't want me in jail every week.
But so the question, I guess it gets back to this. The question is, what can we do? Terry says take to the streets. And we say there are a lot of things we agree, but we can't get anybody, you know, from in front of their computer long enough to protest. What do we do to get people motivated, to wake people up, to get people off
Facebook?
Let me
tell you where I think things are happening. This morning, I was out at a picket line out in Upper Marlboro. There are a group of trucker workers, Teamsters out there, who are striking against the Dacon company out in Upper Marlboro because they haven't stayed at the negotiating table. Mm-hmm. I thought it was important for me to be there to support the workers who are there. But to me, that's where the organizing is happening. Workers fighting for their rights to organize and to negotiate and to fight for decent wages for their for the workforce. I think it's important for us in communities, leave no stone unturned, for us to be out there. And all of it doesn't have to take place on the streets, but I'll tell you one thing. If a hearing takes place in a local community where decisions are being made and you're at home on your computer, not only have you missed the opportunity, but the truth is change won't happen when you're sitting at home.
So what should people do? Give someone listening to the radio show or the people here in this room tonight, give them specific things they can do to help you, to help progressives, to advance a progressive agenda. What can they do?
Let me tell you this. So, for example, we were talking about campaign finance reform. How many people out there who are listening have written letters to their members of Congress and said, you know what, I don't like this system of campaign financing. I want to support you in your efforts. I need to hear that because even though I'm a strong advocate, boy, does it help to know that somebody's got my back.
And it can be an email, right? It can be a letter.
It can be a telephone call. Things that actually show support for progressive positions, because then you give voice and you give backbone to your member of Congress who might otherwise say, well, nobody really cares about that stuff. And really, in my office, that stuff matters, and I actually know that it matters to my colleagues.
I'll tell you this. It's so easy to pick up the phone. I mean, I know the Congressional Switchboard by heart, 202-225-3121. You know, if you're too busy to send an email, you're too busy to write a letter, it's so easy. You call that number, you tell them who your representative is, who your senators are. If you don't know, they tell you who it is. You go to their office and you say, I support public financing. Put me down. This is my name and address. It's that easy.
It's so easy.
So few Americans do it.
Well, it's so easy. And for example, when you look at health care, I knew that I was in the right place on health care because I was hearing from people in my congressional district. I had no doubts whatsoever about where I'd be on health care reform because of that. And so those voices actually do make a difference.
I know you. Oh, go ahead, Terry. Yeah.
Are you implying, and I think you are, I mean, that there's actually more of a voice that the citizens have with the House of Representatives than they do with the Senate, that it's a more effective way to deal with issues that concern them?
I'm just saying it's a smaller district. It's manageable, and so you can get together. If you get together 10 of your neighbors to make a set of phone calls or write a set of emails, trust me, those will get recorded because it's volume. And I mean, really, if I got 10 phone calls in my office today about an issue, I'd say, what is going on out there?
Yeah, but doesn't that fly in the face of what people perceive anyway as reality? That, okay, I get my 10 people and I send my 10 letters or 10 phone calls. Goldman Sachs, on the other hand, is taking you and five other congressmen across the country somewhere or to a dinner or whatever, and you can't possibly... And the weight...
They won't take John Edwards out to dinner.
No.
Not Goldman Sachs.
But the point is, we feel, and I know I feel, because I call all the time and write a letter, that I don't have any of the weight, even if I have the neighbors, compared to those damnable corporations.
You know the difference between Goldman Sachs and those 10 people vote.
Right.
And members actually do listen to that, and senators do actually listen to that. And I think it's a question of how we organize. And so I've been interested. So as a member of the Progressive Caucus, for example, I've been really interested in working with labor unions, with civic organizations, with community organizations to amplify our voice. Because if it's not just the 70 members of the Progressive Caucus, that doesn't do me any good if my other colleagues aren't hearing the same messages, even in a community that may be a majority Republican district. If they're hearing from progressives in that district, it's still 20 people. It's still 10 people. It really does make a difference. I can see that people can say, well, maybe it doesn't make a difference at all. It absolutely does.
And one of the things that we try to do here is to motivate people to get out, because it's interesting. One of the things Terry's talking about is people's perception, and it's a perception of powerlessness. But people, when we encourage people to get out and act, they lose that perception of power. A person who feels powerless, if they send an email or they make a phone call and someone says, okay, I heard you, then they won't feel that powerlessness. So maybe part of the problem, or that's as equally important as what's happening on the Hill, is that people feel powerless, they don't act, and it becomes a self-fulfilling problem.
Well, and a very strong thing in that, even in the financial situation, the best advice I ever got is don't do nothing. Just don't do nothing, because that's when you do feel powerful.
Well, I have a question I want to ask you, and that is, I know you get out regularly in your district, and you do, because I see like the emails where you do like Saturday morning coffee things every week or so, when you have your people come out in your district to talk. What kind of things are you hearing from people? Just curious.
It's really amazing. I think a lot of people who are coming out now are really concerned about the economy. They're concerned about their jobs. Even if they have a job, their money just isn't going as far as it went. There are many people who have jobs but who used to work additional hours who aren't getting those hours anymore. So people are really stretched. They're concerned about jobs. And so I've been really invested in working in the Congress and figuring out a way that we can both create jobs for the people who have been left out in this recession, but we have some people who have been chronically unemployed,
right,
who were left out 2-3 recessions ago. We have to deal with that kind of unemployment.
Congressman Edwards, the Republicans whittled down the stimulus package. I remember they have the aid to the states. There's now another jobs bill that's up that looks like, what do you think are the prospects for that bill? Is it good enough? Should it be better? If you had your jobs bill, what would be in it?
Well, here's the problem with that question is because people ask me this all the time. Wouldn't you have had a better health care bill or wouldn't you have had a better jobs bill? Yes, I could have written that bill in my, on my computer at my house, and it would have gotten one vote.
Right. And so
that's just not the way the process works.
Let me ask you this. What do you think of the current jobs bill? Is it big enough? I mean, what are the good parts about it? What are the bad parts?
I think the good parts about it, a couple of things. One is we finally get some money, about $1 billion into summer jobs. That is really important. We cannot have a whole bunch of young people running across the country without anything to do in the summer. We also, are doing something to try to stabilize states so that they're not laying off all of those really, sort of critical
teachers, police officers,
first responders, those sort of people. I think that we have to have a real manufacturing strategy for the 21st century, and that means investing in plant and equipment and in our infrastructure. And those are job creators that are about the jobs for right now, but really jobs, decades into the future. And so I think we're going to get there in stages. We took this, we did the stimulus package, this chunk here with the jobs package, and we'll come up with another chunk as well.
In your view, is the stimulus package working?
Oh, my gosh, absolutely the stimulus package is working. I mean, I can point to places throughout my congressional district where people really clearly, had it not been for that stimulus package, they wouldn't have a job right now.
Yeah, I know. I travel around Maryland a lot, the far reaches of Maryland, and it's not infrequent.
You've been
that
to the Eastern Shore?
Yes.
Okay.
It's not infrequent that I see those signs where they're resurfacing the roads and say the, what's it called?
Paid for by the...
Yes. I was at a place a few weeks back called Hooper's Island, which is 45 minutes. You know where Hooper's Island is?
I love Hooper's Island there. I fish there.
Oh. I
was at Hooper's Island to go fishing. That's where one of my favorite.
I knew
spots.
Mr. Hooper on Sesame Street.
I always knew there was something about Congresswoman Edwards that I really like. She enjoys fishing and she knows where Hooper's Island is. I was about to say, of all places, out in the middle of nowhere in Hooper's Island, they've got this nice, smooth, new road. There's about 3.5 people on the island, but they've got this nice, smooth, beautiful road. And it's
not a bridge to nowhere, is it?
Well, you've got a lot of seafood houses and things like that in right. there. It's an old fishing community. It's a beautiful part of Maryland.
Seafood production community, actually.
Beautiful part of Maryland.
Are you worried? Speaking of seafood, are you worried about Maryland? We may have to take a break soon, but I want to know if you're worried about Maryland and Chesapeake Bay. Maybe when we come back, we'll talk about that.
In the wake
of the oil spill, because I'm afraid of that loop current. It may come all the way up to Maryland.
Okay,
we're about to go here to a
PSA. I want everyone to know we're here at 1213 U Street. You're listening to 89.3 FM WPFW. Garland Nixon with
Mark Levine
and
Terry D. Kessler.
And most importantly,
Representative Donna Edwards.
All right.
Hey.
So we'll be back in a few minutes, and we're going to we got lots of good things to talk about.
Drilling, spilling, and killing. Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! From oil spills to oil wars, that's the subject of my talk at a WPFW fundraiser Friday night, June 4th, 6 to 8, at Busboys and Poets, 14th and V in Washington, D.C. That's Friday night, June 4th, 6 to 8. This is a fundraiser for WPFW, not brought to you by weapons manufacturers, not brought to you by the oil, gas, and coal companies, but this is media brought to you by listeners like you. Tickets are $50. You can purchase them online at WPFW.org or call 202-588-0999, extension 344. That's 202-588-0999, extension 344. That's June 4th, 6 to 8. I'll just be back from the Gulf. Hope to see you there.
Join award-winning journalist, author, producer, and host of Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman, for an intimate discussion of her latest book, Breaking the Sound Barrier. This benefit for WPFW will take place at Busboys and Poets, located at 14th and V Streets, Northwest, Washington, D.C., on Friday, June 4th, starting at 6 p.m. Hors d'oeuvres will be served. Tickets for this special event are $50 per person. To purchase tickets, visit us online at WPFW.org or call the membership hotline at 202-588-0999, extension 344, between the hours of 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. That's 202-588-0999, extension 344. Thanks.
We'll be right back.
Good evening and welcome back to the Raucous Caucus. Once again, Garland Nixon with
Mark Levine
and Terry D. Kester.
And most importantly,
and
Representative Donna Edwards.
And we are here at 1213 U Street at Ben's Next Door. We're here every Tuesday from 7 to 8 p.m. We have a great time. You're welcome to come on down and join us and ask questions and all that fun stuff. Tonight we're talking about a variety of subjects. We've discussed
campaign finance.
Campaign finance. You know me. I can't remember.
I don't know the Supreme Court.
It was 5 minutes ago.
You forget already what we talked about. Hooper's Island.
The ADD is kicking in
again, buddy.
Oh, my God. The ADD. Okay. So, but now something we want to talk about, and that is Congresswoman Edwards recently came back from Afghanistan, and we're glad to see you made it back safely.
Yes.
One thing I'd like to know is, you were there for three weeks, right?
No. Just a handful of days.
Oh, okay.
So tell us, you know, there's so many questions about what's happening, where we're going, should we leave, should we stay? What did you see when you were there? Were you able to interact with any of the people?
Well, this was my second visit to Afghanistan. Actually, it was a Mother's Day visit, and the intention was to take just a handful of women members of Congress to visit with our women service members, with women in Afghanistan, and also, obviously, to talk to the leadership in Afghanistan and our military and civilian leadership there, too. And I had a chance to really compare my visit Mother's Day last year with mm-hmm. Mother's Day this year. The situation on the ground visited some of the same areas, and so we went into Kabul, down in the south in Kandahar, mm-hmm. and then over to a smaller province called Zabul Province mm-hmm. As well. This year, Speaker Nancy Pelosi went with us on this trip, which was really terrific. There were five members of Congress, women members totally, who went on the trip. And I have to say, I'm not convinced, really, that our strategy is what it needs to be in Afghanistan or whether we need to actually be in Afghanistan. And there was really nothing in the... I mean, this is tough. This is tough, though, because there was really nothing that I really saw either on the ground or heard that makes me any more confident in the president's sort of change strategy today than last year. And in fact, some things actually even more disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly, obviously, the level of violence in Kandahar, which is a stronghold mm-hmm. of the Taliban. It's very, you know, I know that the Karzai government is trying to negotiate with elements of the Taliban now. I know the women of Afghanistan are concerned that what will be negotiated away is their participation in governance in Afghanistan. There's, you know, this notion that somehow there's going to be a central government structure in Afghanistan, a country that has never operated under a central government structure ever in its history and has all these interlocking tribal relationships. And there is deep corruption in Afghanistan, and I'm concerned that our servicemen and women, who are doing an amazing job putting themselves and on the line and sacrificing themselves and their families, and I'm not really sure, frankly, what the mission is in the end.
Terry, you know, you're not one to take a strong stance on things.
No,
generally.
I try to keep it calm and peaceful.
But that's because he's shy and very demure.
Your opinion. Your opinion now. What should we do?
I think what we need to do, and I'd be interested in your reaction, Congressman Edwards, is the problem essentially is the empire. And we are an empire, whether we want to admit it or not. We are an empire in economic terms. We are an empire in military terms, beyond question. And the empire is continually trying to impose its standards, its ideals. Not that they aren't maybe good standards or good ideas, but it's trying to impose them on places like Afghanistan that have had nothing in their history that would lead them to where we want them to be. And as long as we keep on pushing the empire out there, one, we're going to continue to alienate, and two, we're going to continue to be bogged down in perpetual war. And that's what scares me.
Well, I mean, I hear the concern. I'll tell you where I am on this, and I don't want to, you know, sort of label what the United States government is or is not, but I do think in this instance of Afghanistan that we started out in after 9/11 with kind of one goal in Afghanistan, to send out Al-Qaeda. it turns out that there are probably estimates, even those in the public, are there are only about 100 al-Qaeda left in Afghanistan. If you fly over the mountains of Afghanistan, I mean, these huge mountain ranges, and you go 100 people, how are you going to find them? And
you
all those,
you
know, and all those mountains.
They're mostly in Pakistan.
And so they're mostly in Pakistan, where I think there is, you know, sort of grave security question in Pakistan with nuclear facilities there, quite frankly.
But they're also in Somalia, and they're also in the
They are. I mean, and this is the other thing, is that I also think our strategy, if our strategy is around terrorism in Afghanistan, the center really is in Afghanistan. It's actually so diffuse in so many different parts of the region, where I actually happen to believe, for example, if you look at our AFRICOM, at New Africa Command, that if we were actually putting more resources into things like health and welfare and improving the lives and quality of lives of people, that those things would actually have a much bigger payoff in terms of rooting out terrorism and the seeds of it than what we're doing right now. Afghanistan, in some ways, is quite is similar in the sense that everybody who acknowledges what needs to be done in Afghanistan says that there has to be a civil society solution in Afghanistan, and yet 90% of our resources are going into a military solution in Afghanistan. And so even our rhetoric in terms of what needs to happen there doesn't actually match the money. And we know now that, you know, the military is strongly critical because there aren't enough civilian people there. But civilians are like, why do I want to go there? Because it's very dangerous. And we don't understand all the internecine battles going on among the tribes and these tribal relationships that are generations and generations and generations old, that sometimes we actually end up doing exactly the wrong thing with respect to these tribal
relations. Okay, but Congressman Edwards, you know what the right's going to say. It's the same thing they said in Vietnam. It's the same thing they said in Iraq. It's the same thing they've said in really every war in the last 20 years. If we leave, and if the place erupts in civil war into these internecine conflicts between all the tribes, maybe women lose their rights, maybe the Taliban comes back. There's this parade of horribles, I assure you, that anyone on the right, or even some people in the center, fear is going to happen. How do you respond to that?
Well, they're wrong. I mean, they're wrong in the sense that there might be something that our actions would be able to be done to cure that. And so,
do you think the parade of horribles happens whether we're there or we're not?
I do. And in fact, some of that horrible stuff is actually happening right now. And frankly, the level of corruption that's going on, and I know that Secretary Clinton and President Obama have tried to send a really clear message to the Karzai government that they've got to clean this up. You know, but there's no indication really at the ground level that the money that we most need to go, for example, into communities to build schools and hospitals and train midwives and all of those things is even reaching those
communities. Can President Obama afford politically to pick up and say, we've done what we need to do, we're leaving Afghanistan?
Well, I mean, I think not having a strategy at all for how you get out of there is not a good idea either.
Let me throw something into that, because it's a big question, and I would love to know a congressional response to it. How many of you out here are aware of the Institute of Peace? The United States actually
Institute of Peace, yes.
I mean, many?
I know
a couple?
Some.
Okay. I mean, we have...
There were a couple heads nodding.
Yeah, a couple
heads.
But
not the majority.
We have a government agency, a government organization, the Institute of Peace. They're, in fact, building this beautiful new building right at 23rd and...
Constitution.
Yeah, Constitution, right, and... They used to be in a little tiny office in some dink office building. This organization is supposed to be leading us in peaceful efforts. Does Congress, is anybody, including President Obama, even paying attention to the Institute of Peace?
May I throw something in there? One of the things, there's a number of things, though. The Institute of Peace only goes in when requested. There's a lot of restrictions regarding. I've actually interviewed someone from there. So it's not like they can... From what I've seen, take a diplomatic...
No, that's not their purpose. Their purpose is to create understanding within our own government on how we develop strategy, yes?
Well, it is, but I mean, I want to go someplace else, and that is, for example, looking at our State Department. If we take a look at the operations of our State Department in the 8 years prior to the Obama administration coming in, that there were elements of our
Long,
State Department that should
years.
Have been focused on diplomacy that have been just decimated, where there really wasn't a focus on diplomacy. There was this marrying up of our diplomatic efforts with military efforts. And I think that Secretary Clinton has actually spent a lot of time during her tenure thus far trying to reorganize and institute an actual diplomatic State Department. And that's been long missing. So, for example, the elements of the State Department that actually had people who were, had expertise in things like reconciliation, elements of the State Department who actually had expertise, you know, through USAID and actually really delivering real aid. We're having to recreate all of this in this administration, also at a time when it is probably more needed than ever in the world. And so let's give the administration that part of the due. I think, you know, there has been this tendency to say, well, because there was a campaign promise made that the focus really is on Afghanistan, that that then begs the question of having to institute an entire policy predicated on what I think was a mistaken direction. Now is the time that we really have to refocus that, and I think this is an important opportunity. And, you know, we can make a decision about how we want to spend our resources as a government, and when we're policing all of the entirety of the world and sending military arms over the entirety of the world and building up defense infrastructure, it's at the expense of being able to create jobs, being able to invest in an energy future, making sure that our children are educated to compete in the 21st century. Because other nations, you know, you look at Europe, and even though Europe is in a tough economic circumstance now, the amount of money that they are spending on military compared to where we are, it means that they have money to do other things.
That's
it means that Germany can find a couple of billion dollars to say, we're going to, you know, build lithium battery production plants, and we have to scramble around saying, well, we want to do a jobs bill, and the conservatives say, find a pay for, when nobody ever said, find a pay for the war.
It looks like we have a member of our audience that's come forward with a question. Hi, how are you? Welcome to Rock's Caucus.
Thank you.
And your name is?
My name is Anthony.
Anthony.
I wanted to first make a statement. It doesn't seem like our representatives know that. I mean, of course, present company, you know, removed, but the Taliban is not a sports team. It's an idea.
Aren't they the Yankees?
Don't tell anybody. You know, it's an idea.
I thought they were the evil empire. So
they don't all gather together to meet and, you know, put together strategy and things along those lines. It's an ideology. And every time we talk about Taliban and count their numbers and estimate their numbers and talk about how they organize this attack and organize that attack, you know, we do nothing but giving the ideology more prestige. In the same way, whenever we talk about, you know, Americans being radicalized or people in general being radicalized by the Taliban, we dismiss the fact that the Taliban actually have ideas. They have concepts that they have political issues that they are fighting against. And what's radicalizing people is the politics, not the ideas. And, you know, when we don't address that and we don't really deal with the real reasons why people are pissed off and responding in aggressive ways, you know, we don't really do ourselves any good for a nation that'd like to leave at some point, for a nation who would like to leave Afghanistan in some condition, you know, where we can kind of leave with pride. And we basically perpetuate the situation. We keep the cycle running longer and longer and longer. Secondly, Afghanistan was a failed state before. We currently have a puppet. Puppets need to be funded. We don't have any money to fund this puppet, so Afghanistan will be a failed state again. So staying there and kind of keeping the cycle going, you know, it doesn't really do anything for us. We're basically burning through money and burning through bodies, and that's kind of what we do, though. We kind of have a history of that as a nation. So, you know, I'm hoping that we can acknowledge that. We can, you know, send people home, read a couple textbooks, acknowledge that we've been here before, and realize that the only thing we really can do is to leave, and the only way we can possibly leave is to leave in shame, because that's how we went in there.
Well, first of all, I mean, I visited with women in a small rural province, Zabul province, and these are some of the same women that I'd visited with last year, and it was really clear to me that they say they want control of how it is that they both participate and rebuild their own country, and there are not mechanisms in place that really effectively will enable them to
do
that.
So what can we do specifically to help those
women? I respect that. Well, there are a couple of things. Number one, there are parliamentary elections that are coming up in Afghanistan. Afghanistan, I think, is a condition of our continued aid and support of them has to be made to understand that, in fact, when those parliamentary elections come up, that women have to be able to fully participate as candidates, and they can't do anything to undermine that, so they have to be clean elections. We didn't see a clean election before. Have to see a clean election coming up. They have a peace jirga that's in process now, where supposedly the Karzai government is you know, meeting with some of the Taliban leaders for reconciliation. I want to know what the participation of women is in that, because if the Taliban are allowed to reconcile, they can't be allowed to reconcile coming back in under a circumstance where they say, let's throw women under the bus and, like, go back to our own things now just because we're not, we, you know, renounced terrorism. And so my fear is that without, you know, sort of more push on the civil society side, that even the women of Afghanistan aren't going to enjoy whatever the fruits are that might come later, but the people of Afghanistan have to do that. We can't do that for them.
Right. But doesn't this leave us in the quagmire that we're stuck in that Anthony was speaking about? And the reason I mention it, or what I'm trying to get to, this gets to something very fundamental. You know, either we become the policemen of the whole damn world and go around, and because I don't want to see the people in Taliban, you know, subjugated to what the Taliban did, especially women. I mean, and not getting education and everything else. I mean, it's a travesty. But either we create international forces and United States back away from its obsession with sovereignty, or we are going to be the policemen of the empire forever and ever and ever.
I think we're damned if we do, damned if we don't. I mean, it seems to
me
that
if we leave,
I'm worried about the women. And if
but
we
you
stay,
need, you need international.
We're there forever, and it costs us a
you
fortune.
You need international forces
but
to
take
care of
it. But we have some international forces. Do you think we can get more, Don?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, I think it is, I mean, we always hear this talk of the coalition and NATO forces and all of that. I mean, let's be clear. Most of the forces there, the overwhelming majority of the forces there are American forces.
Yeah,
and
that's
I
not
think
an
we,
international.
Do you think we need to actually stop kidding ourselves. I mean, we've asked, and I think that the internet, our quote-unquote international partners, have only stepped up to the extent that they have, even with the asking, even with the change of the strategy that the president announced earlier in the year. There hasn't really been that much sort of step up.
What can be done to get them to step up?
The international community. Look, international citizens of, you know, various countries don't support this effort. What do you mean? What is there to do?
So the answer is they never will
to step up. And so I don't think so. And so, you know, I think that there. You know, this sort of draw up to, you know, we're going to be at about, what, a couple of 100,000 forces there, and that doesn't actually count both the civilian and the support services for the military that aren't on the books wearing a uniform, the contractors. And so this is really, really significant, and the cost is, you know, billions and billions of dollars. And people ask all the time, I mean, we're asking questions about how are we going to pay for, you know, a couple $100 billion jobs package when we've got a multi-trillion-dollar war that we're going to be paying for. And most estimates are saying that, you know, it isn't a 10-year, we're almost at a 10-year commitment. It's 20 or 25 years down the line. The American people actually need to be spoken to much more straightforwardly about what the cost is and what the long-term commitment is. And I think that hasn't really happened. And the only one who can have the conversation with the American people about that is the President of the United States.
Is he going to do that?
Well, here's a question I have. We've got about 15 minutes left. And I'd like to use that to transition a little bit into the midterm elections. Because one of the issues, clearly, and it was one thing we're talking about, to some extent, we've got a tiger by the tail. You know, you let go and you get eaten, and you don't let go, you still have a lot of problems. The Democratic Party came into power, as it were, with maybe the exception of the Senate, with a whole heck of a lot of problems, with just an ungodly mess. And it appears to me that what the Republican Party is trying to do is create a mess and then throw it on the laps of the Democrats and say, hey, you didn't fix the mess, so they ought to put us back in.
You didn't fix 8 years of mess, so put us in.
Right. The question is, how do you address that issue? I've seen heard some of the things that the Republican that the president has been saying. How do you address the issue that these people created an ungodly mess and they left you to try to clean it up, and now they're trying to say, well, they haven't cleaned it up?
They're even blaming Obama for the oil spill.
I think we have to stop being so nice. I mean, I'm one of these Democrats who actually believes that not only did they create the mess, but we need to hold the fan up in front of their faces so that it blows back at them. And I don't think that we've done that as effectively as we can. I mean, we have to continue. As Democrats, we have to not just tell the story, but we have to tell the story in the way they do, over and over and over again. And sometimes what happens is we stop telling the story. And so then it makes it look like it was our mess.
Right.
It was not our financial mess. It was, frankly, even this oil mess was not
of course
our
not.
Oil
I
mess.
I said that, by the way, on Fox today, and they were trying to blame it all on Obama. They were trying to blame everything on the president.
The
and it's weird. Here you have the Mining and Mineral Service, a complete corrupt mess. They were literally in bed with the oil companies. And when I say in bed, yes, I mean having sex.
And we
with.
Knew that during the Bush administration.
They did.
Recall all the stories during the Bush administration.
They were. They were literally having sex with people in the oil companies.
There is that.
Along with the drugs and the Super Bowl trips and the everything else. And now the dynamic is, oh, we may have started the mess, but it's Obama. It happened on his watch. It's his Katrina grievance.
Well, and also they're talking about the president. I mean, I've been listening to this as though somehow the United States government either has or should have the technology to go down 5,000 feet and dig a relief well.
Yeah, why isn't Obama swimming in there and plugging it with? He's not.
Well,
he's Superman,
actually,
right?
I mean, I don't think it should be the role of government necessarily to have that. But we ought to have regulations in process that put a check on it. I mean, one of my complaints against BP is that the Mineral Management Service actually approved a contingency plan for a 250,000 barrel a day spill as a worst case scenario. And here they were estimating 5,000 barrels, saying we're doing everything that we possibly can do. Well, for Pete's sake, what if it had been really the worst case scenario that you got your rubber stamp
right.
approved for that contingency plan? So we, yet another instance where we know as the American public we have to have regulation and that government is good. We found that out in Katrina. We needed government in Katrina. We needed government with the financial sector. We needed government with health care. And we need government here with the oil companies, because otherwise these entities exist and they have no check on their power whatsoever. The only check will be if government is in place and has the ability to put regulations that actually hold them accountable.
Which really comes down to why your constitutional amendment is so damn important. Because at the moment, what we have is corporate states essentially making the primary decisions in the United States.
Well, they make their rules and then they decide not to follow them.
See, I'm not usually a conspiracy-minded person, but I firmly believe that all these Republicans who do not believe in government and do not believe government can succeed appoint all these cronies like, you know, Brownie doing a heck of a job, the Arabian horse trader who supposedly was in control of FEMA with Katrina, and then they say, look, we just proved that government can't work. We messed it up. So obviously government can't work.
Yeah, but give me a break. I mean, here's Governor Jindal down
right.
in Louisiana.
A newfound
here's
socialist.
A guy who says, we don't want any stimulus money because
right.
government can't work.
Right.
And then as soon as this happens, says, oh, please, government's not doing enough for me. They
can't
have it both ways.
It reminds me of some people on Wall
Street,
too, that do the same thing.
Well, clearly the rhetoric never matches because they are against government until such
until
time
they
as
it.
They need government. Something that you know, my favorite subjects is the Tea Party. So certainly I have to touch on Rand Paul. We have about 5 or 6 minutes left. Rand Paul.
He's okay with segregated lunch.
What does he
counters.
Tell us about the political climate going into the midterms? Or does he actually tell us anything about the political climate going into the midterms other than in Kentucky?
I don't know. I mean, I look at the Republican Party and I say, man, what a food fight over there. Let them have it. Because if they want to continue to choose these candidates who really are at the outermost extreme.
Right. Fringes.
They really are, then they can do that. And all it means is that Leader Boehnert's predictions that he'll gain 100 seats in the midterm elections are like, what dreamland is he living in?
Minority
that's never going to happen.
Leader. Don't well, call
let
him leader.
Let me make it a little
minority
more,
leader. Right.
Yeah, let me make it a little more local. I mean, in Prince George County, you've got this incredible sheriff, you know, who's probably going to win again. The sheriff that goes into the mayor of this town, this tall, small town, you know, shoots the dogs, false drug charge, terrorizes the family, terrorizes the mother. This guy, he's Republican, right?
No.
He's Democrat?
He's Democrat.
Where is the Democratic Party then in that case, Congresswoman, in saying this is not an acceptable candidate to represent the Democratic Party after what that sheriff has done in that county.
Well, let me just say this. I mean, first of all, I think that the people in Prince George's County are going to make the judgment about who they want to be their next county executive. And there's a, you know, race. There are a number of people who are in that race, including Sheriff Jackson. I think there are actually, I mean, that incident aside, I think there are actually some things that Sheriff Jackson has done with the Sheriff's Department that are, in fact, good. I know I used to work on domestic violence issues, and when he started out as sheriff, there were, I think, a thousand at least warrants that were outstanding that hadn't been served. And he cleaned that department up. And so I think the voters are going to come up and they're going to decide who's going to be the county executive in Prince George's County. And all of these things are going to be heard out because the story that you just talked about that happened in the town of College Park,
are
going to be part of the discussion and dialogue going forward. And I think there are other candidates that are going to have other things, you know, coming forward. That's part of the process. And then the Democrats will weed through who their candidate is for a general election. It's a majority Democratic county, and so that means that probably whoever wins the Democratic primary is going to win for county executive. I like those kind of battles where you have people who get those issues out and they go across the community and they talk. My fear are these elections where the candidates don't have an opportunity to get their voices out because the corporations are reaching into their pocket to bankroll their own message.
And in fact, right now, as an example, in North Carolina, there's a candidate by the last name of D'Annunzio. He's a Republican who says he's anointed by God and all manner. He's a Tea Party candidate. And the Republican Party, the head of the Republican Party in North Carolina has said he's unfit for unfit for office. However, right now what we're seeing is people can run and anybody can vote for what they want to, and the parties can't control individuals. Everybody does what they want. The people have to look at the different circumstances and make a decision on their own. That there's a party, sure, but ultimately when it comes down to it, if you're a member of the party, if you want to run, God forbid, Terry, if you want to run tomorrow... Certainly, Mark and I would protest on a weekly basis.
Yes, I know you.
But
would.
I'm certainly sure. Well, we're running short of
Terry
time.
Terry runs, I got to run against him.
Yeah, right. I'm going to run from him, in fact. Yeah, but once again, you're listening to 89.3 FM WPFW. My name's Garland Nixon, and I'm here with
Mark Levine
and
Terry DeKester, the next Congressman of the United States,
and Representative Donna Edwards. He won't be for the 4th Congressional District of Maryland.
We're all with you there, and we're here. Actually, you can come here every Tuesday. We're at Ben's next door.
Come join us. It's not, I got to tell you, it's not just that you get to see wonderful us. The food is good. The company is better.
Smokes.
Where else can you have a drink and watch live radio, you know?
Yeah, we have good. In fact, I don't think there's another live radio show here.
I don't think there is in all of Washington, D.C.
Yeah, this is the only live radio show.
Well, not any with this dignity.
Well, yeah, precisely.
Or indignity.
Or, I was about to say, or lack thereof.
Or lack thereof.
Yeah, we've got, okay.
We got a both.
Yes. I just want to make sure that I let everyone know that this show could not have happened. It couldn't have happened without Drew Franklin, who's right over here. He's our engineer. He does an outstanding job. Sidrack Franklin, he's the board operator. He's back at WPFW in the studio. And, of course, the lovely Gladys Brooks, who she keeps us doing things right. And my gosh,
our producer.
I feel sorry. She's our producer, and I feel sorry for what she has to go through. We've got a live audience here. We want to hear it for a live audience. Yeah,
thank you very much.
And you should be here every week.
See you next week, folks.
That's right. And, of course, the people here at Ben's and Nizam and Tariq, they're co-owners here.
The whole family.
Yes,
here,
and the Ali family and the whole Ben's family and everyone next door at we're at Ben's next door.
Too.
Well, next door at Ben's Chili Bowl, which is next door
Ben's
to Ben's next
Bowl,
door.
Yeah.
You know, so... Well, we'll be here next week. We had a great time, and we'll check out. Make sure you go to WPFW.
And we really want to
thank you, Congresswoman.
Thank you. It's been great to be here. I may come back.
All right.
Hey, all right.